Welcome, everybody. And I like to begin my programs by remembering my guru, Swami Muktananda, who always began every one of his programs by saying in Hindi, "Sabko bade sanmane ke saath prem se hridayik swagat." With great respect and love, I welcome you all with all my heart. And he would say that every night, and that was the spirit of his satsang, to welcome another person with love. To begin by welcoming yourself with love, and if you can do that much, then you can welcome another person with love. So in that spirit, I want to welcome you. And as Lilavati said, tonight I'm beginning my series on Shiva process self-inquiry. My intention is to do three talks, one a month up until the retreat, but if I can't fit all the material in, I'll do a fourth one, because who's watching anyway? Who's counting? I also want to welcome everybody watching in the global satsang. Many people watching tonight, and I don't want to mention specific names, except one, I promised. They're watching in New York, Ann Arbor, and in Illinois, Swami Bhagavananda. Let me say hello to you. In Canada, in Japan, and all around Australia, in Adelaide, quite a group, in the Blue Mountains, in Byron Bay, a couple of groups watching. Hello, Byron. And then in Brisbane, that Swami Shivananda's got a group at the center. I want to welcome you all, and then there's other people watching together and individually in Brisbane. So welcome everybody to that. So, the Shiva process. Oh, I should welcome especially a few people I want to welcome. One was we have a guest star from Ganeshpuri tonight, as you might have noticed on the Aarti. A dear old friend, Prasad Hegde. I know him from a very young age. And his father is a trustee of the Bhagwan Nityananda Trust and has a beautiful shop in what we call Chapel Street in Ganeshpuri. And Prasad also has a shop in Ganeshpuri. And what else do we want to say about it? So he's staying, I think, with Lakshmi, eh?
And he's a very good drummer.
He's a very good drummer, yeah. You're not leaving Australia until you transmit some of those beats to...
The drumming made me cry. The Aarti made me cry tonight. I was in Ganeshpuri so much. Thank you.
And I want to introduce Sulochana, who I know for so many years back to my days in Gore Street, in Baba's Ashram in Fitzroy, and who's played the harmonium there for years, and I'm very happy to have you tonight. And I have to mention Brother Cledwin, who's come with his posse. I haven't seen him in a while, and posse. And all kinds of... Well, I want to welcome everybody, but... So, and Mick I should say hello to also. And I don't know, I probably left somebody out. But anyway, Shiva process. I never knew any gnosis till I met the Shiva process. there are a couple more lines, but I've forgotten them. The Shiva process is a direct methodology for understanding the self, for transforming the self, and realizing the self. And it comes in three forms. I think Leela mentioned it. Let's see. I'm going to do the PowerPoint thing. Okay, the personal inquiry, it's a form of meditation. So, when you get stuck, you can use Shiva process yourself. Then there's the second one called one-on-one facilitated inquiry. Pretty cumbersome name, but if you can think of a better title, I'd like it. And this is when you have an experienced Shiva process person helping someone to process themselves, kind of like the therapeutic model, you know. And then finally, scariest and most exciting of all is group inquiry, where you have a group. I thought you could, I was talking about it today with some people, I thought, oh, you could have 15, 16 people. And they said, no, no, never. I said, 8 or 10, they said. So, all right, 8 or 10 is probably an ideal size group. And it's very frightening and scary. And there's even a form of Shiva process that can do it with a big crowd, like 1,000 people or something. But that takes Devima to run the group. We call that the Shakti process. And that is really wonderful. Anyway, the Shiva process is, take that down. My friend Master Charles would call it a contemporization. A contemporization of an ancient and long revered tradition of wisdom from India called self-inquiry or atma-vichara. Atma-vichara, self-inquiry. When I say contemporization, what I mean is that it's a new spin on something very old, because the Shiva process neither ignores nor tries to rise above the emotions, which a lot of yogic methods do. Rather, takes the emotions into account and works to transform and uplift negative emotions. You can't really do yoga without paying attention, especially in the West, without paying attention to the emotions. Now, the ancient sages doubtlessly dealt with these things, but they never spoke about them the way we do. We're so very happy to talk about emotions endlessly from night to day and day to night until everyone is green in the face. And the great sages never spoke about it. They just sort of looked at it like a disease. But Shiva process works with them. In recent years, the modern form of self-inquiry has been mostly associated with the great 20th century Indian sage, possibly the most famous one of the 20th century, named Ramana Maharshi. And that's where I first heard about it, when my first introducer to Eastern things, the American Ramdas, told me about Ramana's method. He said, Ramana goes asking, who am I, who am I? And eliminates everything I'm not. And so finally you eliminate, I'm not my body, I'm not my thoughts, I'm not my emotions, I'm not this, I'm not that. And then he says that at the end of this process, when you've eliminated everything, you go through a doorway and you attain enlightenment. I thought, nice, I like that. It seemed intriguing. It's sort of like that, but that's Ramana's method. But he's not the only practitioner of self-inquiry. A book that we look at a lot here, the Yoga Vashishta, talks about self-inquiry, and it appears many different places. So now, classically, a teacher dealing with a topic begins in the Indian tradition by analyzing the subject word by word. So self-inquiry, there it is, they would say. So we have self, and we have inquiry, or inquiry. Pardon me if I go back and forth. I don't know whether I'm speaking Australian or English or some other language, from inquiry to inquiry. But anyway, so what do we have? Self, it suggests an inquiry into the self, or an inquiry that leads to the self. And the word inquiry implies questions. And I thought about this a lot. The question is a rhetorical device, and a very powerful rhetorical device. What a question does is it focuses consciousness on a particular thing. What's that? When you say, what's that, you've eliminated everything else in the universe and only that thing is focused on. And consciousness powerfully focuses on that. So it questions bring to bear awareness on a particular subject. And thinking about it further, you can realize that all sciences and all human enterprises use the question to focus the light of awareness. Now, I'm a bit of a lunatic about awareness and consciousness and the power of awareness, as you'll probably hear during these talks, so I'm just warning you. I'm a great devotee of consciousness. Anyway, question's very powerful. So physics, for example, asks, what are the laws of the physical universe? What else would you say physics asks? Is that a fair assessment? What are the laws of the physical universe? Okay. Chemistry asks, what are these things made of? No? Psychology asks, what are these insane people, what makes them tick? What makes people tick? A chess player asks, what move shall I play? Or what happens if he goes there? You know, in baseball, the batsman, the hitter, asks, what pitch is this pitcher going to throw me next? And of course, in cricket, he asks, how can I doctor the ball? It's terrible, right? I could give you a whole talk about doctoring the ball in baseball. It's a whole story, but I will refuse to do it. But anyway, all these inquiries are external ones. They ask things about the outer world. And the twist with self-inquiry, of course, is that the inquiry goes inward. And therefore, I believe it's the most, the highest and most profound form of inquiry, at least it is for a yogi. We're always investigating. Human beings are very inquisitive. They're always investigating and exploring. And to me, the final frontier is not space, but inner space. And so when we start to ask, who am I and what's my consciousness about, then we're really moving into the final frontier, which is the spiritual, the inner realm. So inward and outward, I always begin my Learn to Meditate courses by saying the first principle is that we live in two worlds simultaneously. We live in the outer world of objects and things and the inner world, the outer world of matter and the inner world of consciousness. And of course, in Western culture, we've focused powerfully on the outer world. And we need to learn that, or we're beginning to learn, I think, that if we focus on the inner world, it's very rewarding, very empowering, and essential to really understand what it's all about and for happiness and joy and understanding. The inner world, everything in the inner world is consciousness. And breaking it down further, consciousness consists of thought and feeling, a thinking aspect and an emotional, a feeling aspect. In Sanskrit, chit and ananda, consciousness and bliss, chit and ananda. Now, the Shiva process is about working with thought and feeling, that is, your own consciousness. So it's about understanding consciousness, and even you could say it's about a worship of consciousness. We don't realize how important our own awareness is, how sacred it is, how mysterious it is, and how rewarding it is to start to understand something about it. Now, the human predicament, you know, we talk about the human predicament. And what it is precisely is the predicament of consciousness living in a world of matter. That's an interesting, that's what it is. In Christian symbology, they say that's the cross, Jesus' cross represents consciousness in the cross of matter. The problem is matter. If we could control everything without consciousness, we'd have whatever we wanted all the time. But then there's the damn material world, which ignores us. You notice this? So this is the predicament of consciousness living in matter. So as Madonna said, we are living in a material world, and I'm a material girl. Is that what she said? How's that go? But I would say, if she asked me, I would tell her that the second part of the sentence should be, I'm a conscious girl. But then again, maybe on second thought, maybe that's not true. I don't know. But not, I love Madonna. It's all fine. Anyway, while matter is indifferent, consciousness cares too much. It's characterized by, what the scriptures say, raga and dvesa, or attachment and aversion. Have you noticed that? There's just some things you want and some things you want to avoid. And this is the characteristic of consciousness. Consciousness has desires, and the world of matter is completely indifferent to your desires. Consciousness has fears, and the world of matter is implacable and indifferent to your fears. Do you realize what a predicament this is that we live in? To me, this is stark and terrifying. But now, in the Eastern tradition, the realized being, the enlightened person, the siddha, the sage, the yogi, the rishi, is one who can keep his or her inner consciousness balanced, peaceful, and joyous while living this paradoxical relationship with the indifferent outer material world. So despite whatever arises in your life, whatever things go in the wrong way, whatever other people do to you that is not pleasant, whatever things happen, to maintain a loving equanimity is really the goal. And that's no joke, isn't it? It's very difficult to live this life in which this particular situation is and live it with joy. And that's the goal of yoga. So in this real world, there's always tension and frustration. Let's get real. And we can imagine a world of perfect fulfillment. I'm sure you may have done that 12 times today already. But it would have to be a world of pure spirit or consciousness. Otherwise, obstacles are inherent in this material world. But to deal with the inherent problems that face us as spirit living in matter, we do self-inquiry. And we solve the issues of this. Now, actually, we all do self-inquiry naturally, natural form. What movie do I want to go to? Well, I'll go there. What will I do? What job will I take? I'll do that. We go inside and we inquire. And sometimes we do it okay, but sometimes we do this kind of inquiry badly. We discover that there are a number of voices inside of us, and sometimes we listen to the wrong voice. And we know that because we say, in hindsight, I knew I shouldn't have done that. Have you ever said that? I knew I shouldn't have done that. Here's where I can't resist making the joke. Just think about your first two marriages. I'm sorry, I can't help it. It's a really good joke, isn't it? What was I thinking? Sorry. Now, when we do inquiry effectively, we get in touch with what I call the true voice of the self. Of course, if there are false voices in there that tell you, do that, and it's bad, there are also another voice, which you didn't listen to, right? That tell you, do this, and it was good. And so to get in touch with the true voice of the self, we meditate, we do inquiry. And then our inquiry yields good results. So I'm hoping that over the course of these lectures, we can start attuning ourselves to the voice of the self, the true voice. We have to first be able to distinguish the good voices from the bad ones, right? That's one first thing. How do you tell the difference? And the second thing is we have to be strong enough, disciplined enough to listen to the voice of the self and not those glittering other ones that lead us astray down the primrose path. So all this comes from doing effective self-inquiry. Now, as I said, Ramana's question was, who am I? His teaching was a reflection of what you could call his spiritual process, his sadhana. Now, sadhana usually takes maybe 12 years or more or less, but Ramana's took 20 minutes. So he had a unique awakening. He was a 16-year-old kid. He suddenly was gripped by fear of death. And in that moment, instead of having a fit, as we would do, he started to inquire, well, if I die, who will die? And he went, investigated the question, who am I? And in 20 minutes, he attained the self by his own testimony, which was never again broken. He attained permanent connection with the inner self. And his life totally changed. He left home as a schoolboy, and then he was recognized as a great sage, and he was a great sage. And he says he never lost the connection with that self. So if you're hanging out for Ramana's method, good luck. There's only been one Ramana. Every 1,000 years there might be a Ramana. Usually we have to work very hard to connect with that place. Ramana was like a prodigy and a genius. The self-inquiry we're talking about, Jiva process self-inquiry, differs from Ramana's, because it's what I would call Shaivite self-inquiry, which means it not only brings spiritual realization, but can be applied to your normal life. If you give lectures at the NGV, you can use it there. It can be used anywhere. It's a method. Self-inquiry is a method. What they call, the yogis call it an upaya, a means, a method. A practical instrument, like a hammer. When do you use a hammer? Well, you don't use a hammer when you need to screw a screw in. You use it when you need to hammer a nail. So it's each upaya has a particular use. So a scalpel is a method, a bat is a method, a pen is a method. And to use self-inquiry, you don't need to have a particular religious philosophy or religious stance. So tonight I want to do two inquiries, a short one, and then the essential method of inquiry that constitutes the Shiva process. But first, a concept and a definition, not a hard one, and that is upward shift and downward shift. If you hang around the ashram, you'll hear people say, oh, I had a downward shift. Do they say that much here? Oh, yeah. Now, that gave me an upward shift. Kashmir Shaivism says that when consciousness expands, there's light and joy and wisdom and love. This is the upward shift. It also calls that the movement, the process in the universe called grace. Grace is the upward shift, the expansion and upliftment of awareness. So whenever you say, oh, I got a good mark on that, ah, you love me, ah, I got the job, ah, right? This is the upward shift. However, when consciousness, according to Shaivism, when consciousness contracts, and there's ignorance, there's depression, there's density, this is the downward shift. It's the opposite of grace, of the movement of grace. It's called in Shaivism the movement of concealment, which is interesting because that implies something. It implies that the proper movement of the universe is grace. Isn't that lovely? Because I was used to the Western notion where grace is very hard to come by. Mostly we're conceived in sin, we're all sinners, we're all living in the contraction. But in Shaivism, the proper movement is of joy and of upliftment and love and grace. And it's only through this thing called concealment or maya, ignorance, that we're cut off from it. But if we got stopped doing that, because we do it to ourselves, we would live in an expanded universe of joy and grace.
Yes.
Yes. Is what?
A gift given.
Yeah.
Your teacher said, there's no word for it. It's like the upward shift. It's like, oh, grace has just appeared. You don't have to work for grace. It's like the upward shift. If I'm kind and loving, the upward shift occurs.
But you have to be kind and loving. You have to open to it. So yeah, no, it is.
It's not a job. You don't have to work hard to get it.
Oh, it's a hard work. Listen, that's all well and good. It's all true.
You taught me the Shiva processing.
Okay. It's all true, Cledwin, but it's all true. And you can't work towards the spiritual goal. Can't be attained by work, but you have to work damn hard to do it anyway. So you have to make a lot of... It's a paradox. But you're right, but you have to position yourself so that you're open to that grace. But I mean, that's a wonderful thing. Anyway, we won't argue that this is where religious wars come. If you grab him in the hallway, please, and pummel him sufficiently.
What? It's just grace, though, I guess.
There's only grace, baby. All right, so all that aside, during the course of a day, there are many upward shifts and downward shifts. You agree to that?
Yes.
This happens. And so the first contemplation I want to do, I call reviewing your day. So it's on page 58 of my book on self-inquiry. But we'll do that. Let's do this. So to do this, it's a little... I'm going to put the things up there, but you're supposed to keep your eyes closed. So so this is a slightly irrational act I'm doing, okay? But don't worry about it. Okay, so... So first, close your eyes and think about the day you've just had. Review the day in sections. Think about your morning, what you did this morning, what happened this morning, just lightly, you don't have to go into details. What happened this afternoon and this evening. And I have some questions to ask you about it. First one. Did your emotions shift and change during the day? Next, did you have an emotional reaction to any event or encounter? That could be positive or negative. You saw that person, particularly regarding negative experiences. Did you handle the emotion immediately or not? Did you sort of come away from it a little upset? did that emotion, that negative emotion, affect later events during the day? And is the feeling still with you? Now, two questions. One is, what did you need to do at the time to shift your experience? At the time of that encounter, what did you need to do? And finally, what do you need to do right now if they still have a residue of that experience to shift it right now? And let the answer just come to you. Okay, let's open our eyes. We're not going to do much more, but it's so interesting. Our life is a succession of encounters. And supposedly in the enlightened state, every encounter is an encounter with God, or with joy, or with love. But in practice, we have all kinds of encounters. Some have a downward shift, some have an upward shift. But we can work with it and increase the upward shift, the percentage of upward shift. Now, I want to go towards the main... That review is very useful. If you sit down, you can work out a lot of stuff and prevent a lot of future pain. Patanjali says, the pain is one of the most wonderful and memorable aphorisms in all of spiritual literature. Patanjali says, Hayam dukam anagatam. The pain that is to come can and should be avoided. Isn't that lovely? Thank you, Patanjali. It can. That's nice to know that it can be avoided. And it should be avoided. So, all right, we can take that out. Now, I said that Ramana's inquiry is, who am I? Mine I would call New York inquiry. It's what's going on here. What's going on here? If you think about it, what's going on here is the first question that we ask in any situation. Maybe if you're from New York, it's the question you ask. I don't know. We enter a room and look around. What's going on here? How does an Australian say that? What's going on here? Who do I know here? Right? Is there anything that draws my interest here? Or my attention? Is there anything that threatens me? That's real New York inquiry. Okay, it's cool? Yeah. Anyway. So in a moment we'll do the essential inquiry of the Shiva process. And we'll ask inwardly, what's going on here? And we're going to investigate four major centers within the body, the navel, the heart, the throat, and the third eye. This little investigation begins every Shiva process in all its forms by investigating tensions in these areas, the navel, the heart, the throat, and the third eye. Whether it's individual work or group work or whatever. Now, the Vedantic approach, of which Ramana is an example, tends to withdraw from the world. As I said, the Shaivite approach, or the Tantric approach, is world-affirming. It says this world is nothing but God. And it has faith that wherever you dig, you may not find water, but you'll find God. God, or if you prefer, universal consciousness is the center of everything. And my first understandings of Shiva process came while I was sitting in Baba's presence, Swami Muktananda's presence. And so I actually credit him with most of the main thing by his transmission. I was an extreme yogic striver in my early days in India. I was trying to attain the citadel by force. I was going to attain samadhi in record time. And I had lukewarm results, I have to admit. I would attain a certain state, but then the effort was so unnatural that I would crash and burn. I couldn't hold it. So one day I was sitting in front of Baba, striving for enlightenment. Now, a great yogi like Baba, who was the greatest of yogis, conducts an enormous shakti, power, enormous power, spiritual power. And when you sit with him, this power affects you, and it moves through you, and it hits your blocks, and so on. It can experience it as great bliss, and you can experience it as a great fry. So I knew the frying part very well. And my mind was sitting there going, you know, he's sitting there, he's like full of joy, and I'm going, when will it happen? When will it happen? And at some point, I became aware of myself enough to see that, God, there's Baba radiating joy, and I'm sitting there tense as hell, misery, and very far from the state that I was wanting or contemplating. And so I must have relaxed in that moment, and a realization came up from inside me, as though it was a voice. I really heard a voice speaking, and it said, a very funny statement, it said, you can't have the meditation that you want, but you can always have the meditation you're having. Now, you know, I was a child of the 60s, so maybe Mick Jagger deserves a footnote. You know, you can't get what you, what is it? You can't always get what you want, but you get what you need. But you can't, the meditation I wanted was pure samadhi, ecstasy, like the ultimate LSD trip, pure oneness, ecstasy, joy, wow. So I couldn't get that, but I could have the meditation I'm having, which is whatever it was, like the scattered mind meditation or the nervous twitching meditation, or what, you know. And it was really funny, and I got it when I heard that. I said, "What?" I had what we would call in the academy a paradigm shift. I realized that I had to replace my old method of striving to be where I wasn't, because this striving is, I don't want to be here. I want to be there, with acceptance of where I was. So if I can have the meditation, I just start with where I am and be present to it and investigate it. You see that difference? It's a profound difference. Instead of going after some unknown goal, you know, which is like, you know, when is this going to happen and where is it and what is it anyway? I'd say I could begin right where I am and investigate my present state, investigate what's already the case. And I realize this is a much more comfortable task. It's also very Zen. In Zen, they say meditation should be just sitting. They don't even tell you what to do. They say, just sit there. You don't have to strive for anything. Just sitting is good enough. And, you know, later there are different versions of this. My first teacher, Ram Dass, said, be here now. And Eckhart Tolle talks about the power of now, being present. And so on. So, this is the method. To have the meditation you're having and investigate. You don't need to do a ritual, you don't need to do a puja, you don't need Sanskrit, you don't need religious paraphernalia, all of which are good, by the way. You don't need a belief system. You just deal with what is and continually unpack it, with the idea that if you keep unpacking it, God is at the bottom of the unpacking, the bottom of the suitcase. God is at the bottom of the suitcase, of every suitcase. And you know, an idealist says this is wrong, but a realist says this thing exists. We might want to change it, but the first thing is to investigate it. So I think that's enough for the first content of the first day, but now we're going to do the meditation. And this is the essential contemplation. And then if you couldn't understand what I've been talking about so far, this will make it very concrete. And in this contemplation, as I said, we're going to examine what's going on here, particularly in these four spots, the navel, heart, throat, and the third eye. And it's a series of questions about what's going on there. And then afterwards, we'll do a little more with it tonight. So, let's do it. Now let's close our eyes. We'll begin our investigation. We'll turn the light down a little bit. This only takes 5 or 6 minutes, this part. Then I'll come back and I'll ask you some questions. Okay, so close your eyes, go inside, and get in touch with your inner experience. What does it feel like inside yourself? And then bring your attention down to the area of your navel. Feel the feeling in the navel area. Does that feel pleasant or unpleasant? Does it feel tense or relaxed? Feel the feeling in the navel area. Now let's bring our attention up to the heart area, the emotional center in the center of the chest. Feel the feeling in the heart area. Does that feel pleasant or unpleasant? Does the heart feel open or closed? Does the heart feel sad or happy or some other feeling? Feel the feeling in the heart area. Now let's bring our attention up to the throat area. And throat is the communication center. Feel the feeling in the throat area. Is it pleasant or unpleasant? Does it feel tense or relaxed? Does the throat feel blocked or open? Feel the feeling in the throat area. Now we go up to the final spot, the third eye, the Ajna chakra, in the center of the brow. Become aware of the feeling in the brow center. Does that feel pleasant or unpleasant? Does it feel tense or relaxed? Looking into the third eye area with your inner eye, does it seem dark or light in there? Now, before we come out of this, I'd like you to do one more thing. Go back over the four centers and see which one is the best one, which means the most expanded and relaxed and pleasant one, and which one is the worst one, the most contracted or unpleasant one. Take a moment to see which is the best and which is the worst. Take a moment for that. Okay, let's open our eyes, come into the room, and just have one more little thing we'll do. Okay, first I'd like a survey. I'd like you to vote on which your best and worst was. Now, sometimes people have two that are about the same. You're allowed to vote twice, but not more, in each category, okay? All right, got that? All right, should we do best or worst first?
Worst.
What?
Worst.
What?
Worst.
Worst first. That's right. That, see, in New York, we always want to know the worst-case scenario. Because anyway, if you start with the best and you go to the worst, that's a down.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll do worst first, all right? So which one is your worst one, okay? If two are about equal, you can vote twice in this, all right? So I'll tell you, we'll start with the navel, we'll work up. How many of you had the navel as their worst one or equal tied for worst? Okay, I'm just going to do this impressionistically. That's a pretty good bunch. All right, how many had the heart worst or equal tied for worst? Navel's way ahead of the heart, okay. How about throat, worst or equal tied for throat looks equal to the navel. And third eye, equal worst or not? Okay, I would say just by impressionistically that the throat and the navel were worst in this group and the other two were about equally less worse, right? You people are navel and throat people. Okay, so now we'll do the other part. The problem, you can already anticipate. Same deal. I want you to pick the best one, and if two are equally best, you do that, right? Okay, so how many found the navel the best or equal best? A smattering of hands. How many found the heart best or equal best? Quite more. How many found the throat best or equal best? Same smattering. Yeah, it's the opposite. And how many found the third eye the best or equal best? Quite a bit. So we can say from this, we can tell sociologically, statistically, from my paper in Sociology of Consciousness, I gathered my statistics that this group had good heart and third eye and bad throat and navel. Is that right? Okay. My paper I'll have to do a bit more rigorously. All right, so now what does it all mean? I think I'd like to inquire and find out. I'd like to go back in and ask you a few more questions, okay? And what we're going to do next is we're going to take the worst one, worst center. If you had two that are equal, pick the worser one. You know, pick one that's juicier, the worst one. Make a decision, okay? So, and then I'm going to ask you three questions. And then we'll see what we get to, okay? Ready? You pick the worst one? Okay, close our eyes. Go inside. And get in touch with it. You may not want to because it's unpleasant, but get in touch with that feeling there. And the first question is, what is this feeling? And since it's a negative feeling, it's probably either in the anger, fear, or sadness families. For example, anxiety is in the fear family, and impatience is in the anger family, and so on. So is it more like anger, fear, or sadness? Okay, the next question, you're going to have to just let an answer come from within. And the question is, what caused this feeling? Did something happen today? An encounter? A conversation? Or is it something that's been with you for a long time? Or is it caused by a relationship with some person? Something? Ask yourself, what caused this bad feeling? Let the answer come. And now, in some ways, the most important question, and let the answer come to you spontaneously from within. Third question is, what do I need to do about this? To harmonize this feeling? Do I need to do something externally or internally? Do I need to reach out to someone, or do I need to renounce something inside, in the inner world? What do I need to do to deal with this? Okay, let's open our eyes. Come into the room. Now I have one more question for you. How many of you got an answer to the third question I just asked? Either definitely an answer or possibly an answer, both categories. There's what do you need to do? How many? Wow. Wow, that's like 85% or something, no? Really good. That is very good inquiry. Now, now I'm going to ask you to, do we have a roving mic? Is that too scary? I'm going to ask you to share what answer you got.
Ask if anyone
would. What? Would, oh, yes, that, thank you. Would anyone like to share? Now, you don't have to get, yeah, there's a brave man. But you don't have to tell the gory details. For example, you say, well, you know, if you have some really ticklish, you could just say, I learned I had to do something, this, that. Okay, go ahead, tell us.
My name is Brendan.
What is your name?
Brendan.
Brendan, hi, Brendan.
And a few months ago, I came back from living in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I had this sort of bad feeling of anger in my navel. And I felt it was about just bad experiences I had there. And I need to let go of that.
That is immaculate. You've never done cheaper presses, have you?
No, no.
That's an immaculate.
Yeah.
So he found out that he had
anger there.
He saw that it was related to some experiences there in Vietnam.
And I just need to take positive steps for my life going forward rather than being sort of.
That's fantastic. That's really good.
Thank you.
Really good. Wow. I think I feel like retiring now. That was so good. People have been trying to get me to do that for years. What? No, that was really good. Anybody brave enough? So you didn't tell what horrible experiences they were, although we'd love to know. No. We don't want to know. Uh-oh, Cledwin.
Thank you. It's just beautiful. The life I live, we live under the direction of bishops, men who are in charge of the way we live. And my challenge with our bishop and our primate bishop is to speak the truth to him about how I feel and to have a right to speak. Now, a Franciscan brother speaking to a primate bishop, there's a different level. But one of the things that Shiva processing has shown me, that there isn't a level, there's just the truth. So I felt sort of nervous in my throat, and then I just spoke, and I do need to speak to him the truth. And the truth will set me free. So thank you again, Swamiji.
So you thought of a specific thing.
Yeah,
you
I
need
did,
to
of
say
a situation to. Right now that's current in our order.
That's
with
great.
Our primate
that's
bishop.
Great.
Thank you.
Perfect. That's very good. See, this is all the wonder of consciousness, that the answers are there and that they unpack different blocks in our life. And so that's the essence of Shiva Prabhupada. Anybody else want to give us? Oh, you have one. Yeah.
Mine was an old feeling in my navel, and the feeling was fear. And it's a big challenge for me because it's always there. And I think what I felt was that I have to just keep feeling the feeling and pray to Bhagwan, to you, to help it dissolve.
Yeah,
it's very old, you know, and it's just to know that that's what it is.
So interestingly, just that you got a thing that was an outer thing. It said, speak to this bishop, while you got something that inward, that's a yogic, like to just not run away from the feeling,
yeah,
and just be with it, and you know.
Yeah.
So it may be, you know, you may have to do something externally or you may have to do something internally.
Yeah.
So the process will show you that.
Yeah, just to know that that's what it is. Just
okay.
Think, oh, here it is again.
Does it go back, way back in your life?
Yeah.
Previous lives? When did it go
probably.
Back?
Oh, I was probably born with it.
Okay, great. So those are great, yeah, good. Can we do one more, or we had enough?
If there is one more.
Is there one? It's a great service to share this because people can relate to it. Ah, there she goes. You see, we're ultimately the same inside, whether we're a bishop or a lay brother or a pope or a guru
or a swami,
yeah. We all operate according to the same principles. Yes?
Mine was the throat chakra.
Throat, yeah.
Yes, something happened that I saw my father do when I was a child. And I tried to tell other people about it and no one would listen to me. And so I'm always choked in trying to explain anything to anybody because of that time. But what I came to the realization of is I only needed to forgive my father.
That's beautiful. That's very beautiful, yeah. Yeah, okay. Wow, I think we should leave it there. That's beautiful. Just, can we show the slide 6, I think? The one after that. The different centers?
Yep.
Oh yeah, the 4 centers, just quickly. Yeah. So the navel, I call the... Oh, the guns go that way. Okay, there's navel, the heart, the throat, and the third eye. And the navel, I call it the vital center, the moving center, vitality. The heart's what?
The emotional,
the emotional center. The throat's the
communication.
And the third eye? The intellectual center. Okay. So now, all right, let's do, I think that's enough for tonight. We'll do one, we'll meditate now. I'll say one or two things after we're done with the meditation. So in this meditation, we'll just meditate for 5 minutes. And now go to your best center. Your best one. And go off with it. If the feeling is clarity, immerse yourself in clarity. If the feeling in that center is love, flow in love. If the feeling in that center is wisdom or insight, flow in that. If it's energy or joy, flow with that. So let's go to the best center and immerse yourself in that just for 5 minutes. Let's do that now.